I got this email from a listener named Jade who says, "Hi, any chance of getting a podcast on service failures? I've been in hospice for around 2 years. I hear the term thrown around, but can't quite grasp all the details. I don't see any podcasts or blog posts around this subject, but I suspect the knowledge would be quite valuable. Thanks, Jade." Well, Jade, I think that's a great idea for a show. So today, we are going to talk about service failures. This is James Dibben, and welcome to the Hospice Nursing Podcast. Well, hello, fellow hospice nurses, and welcome to your show. That's right, this is the only show that provides practical help for hospice nursing success. I'm your host, James Dibben, with confessionsofahospicenurse.net, and thank you for joining me today. Well, hello. Welcome to what is going to be episode 49. I cannot believe that we are at episode 49 now. And wow, what a ride this has been, and apparently will continue to be as I keep getting requests for shows. And I love the request for shows. So should you want to send me an idea for a show that you would find very beneficial that I haven't hit on, please do so. Email, call. I give all that information at the end for you. And so this week, thanks to Jade, I have some ideas and to talk about what service failures are. Okay. And I'm going to try to hit on two different categories, like big overall categories of service failures. And they are the conditions of participation that Medicare requires, and then I think they can be broken down to agency philosophy of care, because there are different philosophies of care out there, and I've learned this over the years, having worked for multiple different hospice agencies and seeing what their philosophy of care is between the different agencies, because some will take some kinds of equipment and IVs and some won't, and some will do antibiotics and some won't, and different things like that. So agencies are different, but there are conditions of participation that Medicare sets forth. And so I'm going to start there, because these conditions of participation are non-negotiables. And should you mess any of them up, they can result in a service failure for your patient. And we'll get into that a little bit. This, I'm trying to keep this episode from being mostly about the conditions of participation, but those drive what it is we do. They create the framework. That's the umbrella that we function underneath, is our conditions of participation that Medicare has set forth. I still want to hit agency philosophy items, but I'm going to do that as the second half of this episode. But you can have service failures with either one, and I'll tease that out here a little bit. And because when you fail at a condition of participation, those kind of service failures result in a discharge of the patient, like an administrative discharge, and then a readmission. So you're having to show up to a patient's house that you botched something up in your conditions of participation, what Medicare requires of you. You did something wrong in there, and it's forcing you to have to discharge the patient and then readmit them. And that is a major service failure, because now you're contributing to the confusion of a patient. Like, wait, you need me to sign papers? Why? And then you're trying to explain it. So I think it's beneficial to hit on some of those items here. And probably the best way to describe a service failure are when the patient's needs aren't being met. And sometimes those needs are even perceived, right? Maybe those needs are something where you're like, well, that's not really a need, but it's what the patient perceives. And sometimes perception is reality. Oop, pardon me. So let's talk about that. So the Medicare conditions of participation. And so there is actually, I'm going to put a link in the show notes to a PDF that I got from the NHPCO, the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization, or OPERA. I don't know what those stands for. I didn't look. But you can get a lot of stuff from NHPCO. And so some of this stuff I've drug out of there just to verify some of my own information that I'm going to lay out. I want to make sure I'm not saying something wrong, because there's some misunderstandings in hospice at large that I'm going to touch on just for a second. But let's go ahead, and I don't want to stall a bunch of time, because I've got two really full pages of notes here that I'm wanting to try to hit. So be sure in the show notes, I'll put a link to the PDF from the NHPCO, but you know, just for reference, it'll be available at confessionsofahospicenurse.net in the downloadable tools section. Is probably where I'm going to stick it, so that way you have quick access to that. Hold on, I'm going to mute this for half a second. All right. So we'll start with this: the election of hospice benefit. And I think this is one, and I've talked about it a little bit here on a recent show about in the Don't Say Hospice episode. I talked about this a little bit, but it's really important that the patient, or at least the caregiver, if the patient is confused, knows what they're signing up for. And ultimately, when you leave the patient or family members present, whoever has cognitive abilities, they better know that they are signing up for palliative care. They are signing up for hospice palliative versus curative care. And I think some agencies will miss this. And when you look at the conditions of participation, when it comes to election of benefits, it is very explicit on there that they better have a full understanding that that they're signing up for palliative, they're signing up for comfort, they are not signing up for cure. And I had this conversation with a patient here recently, because it was a really tough admit. The patient was super young, and I really wanted them to have full understanding of what it was they were signing up for, because we have to remember, I told them, I said, none of my nurses are going to ever walk into your room and go, oh, you don't look very good, you should call 911 and go to the hospital. You're not signing up for that kind of health care. And when they don't know that, and they think that you're going to encourage them when it's time to call 911, by the time they figure out that you're not going to tell them to do that, their condition has deteriorated significantly. And they're really now, they're worse off than ever. And I don't want to spend a ton of time on that, but a major service failure is when you have a patient who signs up for hospice care and doesn't understand what it is. And we're going to talk a little bit. There's another spot down here a little bit lower where I'm going to tease that out a little bit. And that will be more on the hospice philosophy side. I probably could have stuck it here, but I moved it down further. So you've got the election of the hospice benefit, but you also have the IDG/IDT. And so different places call it different. When I got into hospice, everybody call it IDG, interdisciplinary group, but a lot of places call it IDT, which stands for interdisciplinary team. I don't care which one y'all want to call it, but there has to be a fully functioning IDT, an interdisciplinary team. And so This is also known, when you look at the regulations, as core services. And when you think of core services, that means services that if you don't provide those, you are not technically running a viable hospice agency. Okay? And so you cannot have any one of these members, I'm going to name them off, without one of these members, you are basically in violation of the conditions of participation for Medicare. And should they find out that you are not, you do not have this member of the team available, they will deny payment to you. Now, everybody gets all worked up, and well, if Medicare finds out you made this mistake, you're going to lose your license. I can't count how many nurses are like, I'm protecting my license. Listen, unless an agency is intentionally defrauding the government, and that means everybody is getting together going, I know these patients don't qualify, but I'll sign it if you'll sign it, and we'll sign it and make money. But when you make mistakes on the conditions of participation or have an issue or a problem, everybody's license isn't at risk because you screwed up, all right? They just go, we're not paying you until you fix it. And so here's the list, okay? A medical director who can be a medical doctor or a DO, an MD or a doctor of osteopath. But you got to have two. You have to have a backup. Your medical director is going to at some point go on vacation, and your IDT is going to have to be covered, and there has to be another doctor. You just can't skip the doctor for the week. You have to have an RN. Having an RN is not difficult. Like, you know, if it's bad weather or if a bunch of patients are sick and needing visits and the only nurse who's at IDT is the clinical director, or the clinical director is even off and one of the other nurses, as long as a registered nurse is in attendance and you only need one, you're compliant. You got to have a social worker. You better have a backup social worker, even if they're agency and you can contract with them. You can't have an IDT without a social worker. You can't have an IDT meeting without a social worker. Okay. And then a chaplain. You can't have an IDT meeting without a chaplain. If your chaplain is sick and can't even call in, you got to have another chaplain that can come in. You better have a PRN backup chaplain. You got to have that chaplain there. So simply it's four people: medical director, RN, social worker, chaplain. If you're missing any of those, you have violated the conditions of participation and you have a service failure to your patient because now they are, Medicare could have you discharge every single one of your patients and readmit them because you did not have a fully functioning IDT. All right. Next is admission. All right. There's a few things to understand about your admissions process. You got to have a medical director that reviews the records and approves the admission. Now, listen, a nurse, LPN or RN, can go and assess a patient, gather data. There's some argument out there. Oh, LPNs, they can't assess the patient for qualifying for hospice. What the heck are you talking about? All they have to do is gather the data and present it to the medical director. They're not deciding if the patient qualifies for hospice. They're gathering data, taking vital signs. An LPN can listen to lungs. An LPN can assess a patient head to toe for everything. All right? I've been an RN for 9 years. I was an LPN for twice that. Okay? And so I assessed a lot of patients. Nursing homes are ran by LPNs. Thank you, LPNs out there. But the point being is that ultimately the medical director determines if a patient qualifies. And it is not okay for you to have this great relationship with your medical director and for that medical director to say, listen, you know, if you're in doubt, call me. Otherwise, just admit them and figure out the diagnosis with your clinical director. Guess what? That is not cool. It happens a lot. It's happened to me. I can't say... I would be lying to you if I said I've never been in that situation because I have. And in retrospect, it's just not cool. My medical directors are getting paid to have a certain job and a certain responsibility. So I don't mind the doctor saying, I don't know, I'm struggling between these diagnoses. What's your opinion? What are you seeing? You know, and you can collaborate and figure that out as the assessing nurse. But ultimately, the medical director decides, and you should be getting a verbal approval from your medical director on every single admission your agency performs. All. Okay. And then your RN, guess what? Has 48 hours to complete that first comprehensive assessment and start up the care plan. Now, many of you might be going, oh, you can't do that. It has to be an RN on the first day. Most agencies do it that way because let's have an RN who's an admit nurse and goes and completes it. But man, on Friday nights around here sometimes, I have one RN for the weekend and I have an LPN that's kind of triaged and helps make visits. And if we have two admissions drop on a Friday, the RN goes and completes one and the LPN goes and does a tuck in and signs consents with the other one. And then the RN will go on Saturday and do that second comprehensive assessment. So I've started changing up my wording just a little bit. And I'll just say, well, the LPN is going to get consents and the RN will complete the comprehensive assessment tomorrow. I don't say the RN will do the admit tomorrow. No, the LPN did the admit yesterday. The LPN is going to do the admit tonight, make sure they got comfort meds, make sure they're comfortable, do some teaching, review the consents, make sure they know they're signing up for hospice. And then the RN will go out the next day. I don't like pushing the 48-hour thing. 24 is cool. You can do 48, 24 is cool. And then the RN goes out the next day and fires up everything, does the comprehensive assessment. Okay. Another area of the conditions of participation is understanding the different types of discharges that we have in hospice, because we can definitely have a service failure if we don't understand what discharges should look like and which kind of discharges we can do. So I just want to review those real quick for you here. And just so you have an understanding, okay? The one that I think we run into a fair amount is our revocations. And so a revocation is a patient's choice. You can't say, I'm going to go revoke this patient. Now, I think there's some nuance to how you say it. Because if you have a patient who's decided to go to the ER and you're going to go see them and you're going to take a revocation form with you for them to sign because you recognize that they want more aggressive care than what we're giving them. So you can meet them in the ER and say, listen, you know, what is your thought process here? But we shouldn't just ram the revocation down their throat and say, here, sign this so you'll come off of hospice. Like, you got to get with them and help them and help figure out why it is they went to the ER. And then say, okay, well, you know, it's obvious that you're not wanting end-of-life care. You are wanting more aggressive treatment because this edema is out of control and you don't understand why we're not willing to do IV Lasix. And so they sign the revocation, okay? But just in your mind, you need to always remember that a revocation is patient's choice. So then the other one is no longer terminally ill. So for these no longer terminally ill patients, you're going to present them the notice of Medicare non-coverage, and you have to do that 48 hours before you discharge them. And I'm really big on this one as a possible service failure because I've seen agencies where they kind of drag their feet on having this discharge conversation, and then they get to the week before you're supposed to recertify them at IDT, and the nurse is like, oh, I don't think they qualify. And you're like, well, but we're supposed to recertify on Tuesday and the end of the benefit period ends here. And oh, a panic ensues. And that really drives me crazy because then we have a rushed discharge of a patient. And that can be very traumatic for them going from a nurse that's coming twice a week and the home health aide who's coming twice a week and the chaplain and the social worker. And then all of a sudden we come running in the door on a Thursday and go, oh my gosh, I'm sorry, but you don't qualify for hospice anymore. We got to discharge you today, man. If that's not a service failure, I don't know. Like that's the worst kind of service failure. So the thing about somebody no longer being terminally ill or extended prognosis, like a lot of agencies call it, is you still need to have an IDT meeting where it has been determined that as a team, you guys, everybody agrees, everybody in the room, the RN, the social worker, the chaplain, and the medical director are all like, yeah, man, we are just, this is custodial care. This is a patient who is not changing. We're not declining. Their risk factor is low at this point for them to die in the next 6 months. But the medical director, ultimately, once everybody has rendered an opinion, it ultimately falls to the medical director's feet to decide. And it's not the job of anybody in the room to convince the medical director one way or the other. It is our job to provide data and documentation on the patient condition, regardless of what it looks like, and for that medical director to decide. Okay? We can discharge for cause, and that one should not happen very much, but that happens for a variety of reasons. Maybe it's not safe in the home. Maybe it's so gross and so dirty, or so many, you know, pets that you can't safely provide care. Maybe you have a patient who hardly won't let you come in and see them. They can't really participate in the plan of care. And so you got to let them know, hey, listen, you know, you're not letting us do your job. Hopefully this turns into more of a revocation than a discharge for cause, but you can do it. You can discharge for cause if you just can't even get in the house to see the patient and have them sign something. They got forced into it by their family, and they actually really don't want you there. There's some variety that can catch you to discharge somebody for cause. Sometimes it's because somebody is belligerent or disrespectful of your staff or racist. I ran into that too, where they're like, we don't want anybody who looks like this coming into our house. And I mean, if it's bad enough, I don't know if I'm going to keep you around. Okay. But the point being is that you can discharge for cause. The other discharge type is a transfer. And if they just say, listen, it's not working out with you guys, I think I want to try a different hospice, or I move into a different area and want to be admitted over there, then you can transfer to another hospice, or they moved out of the service area. Some agencies, and it's okay to do this, will use moved out of the service area if a patient goes to the hospital on Friday and you don't find out till Monday and they got admitted to this hospital that you, like, you know, you don't contract with them for services. Like, you don't have a general inpatient contract there, or a respite contract or something that you can kind of keep them on service with, but they truly went into a facility you don't have a contract with for what it is they wanted. And so you can discharge them moved out of service area. You can't provide services to them where they are. And so you can do that moved out of service area type discharge. And sometimes that, and you can use that when they say, well, I'm moving from California to Missouri, you know, and we're doing it tomorrow. And then you're like, well, that's not enough time to get another agency to transfer, because a transfer has to happen same day. A patient can't move out on Monday and move to a different city on Monday, and then on Thursday you guys do a transfer. It has to be same day. So that, you know, understanding your discharge types and not screwing those up. Face-to-face requirements. Okay, so this is technical for you newer hospice nurses out there. There are benefit periods in hospice, and hopefully not very many of you listening to this don't know that or don't understand them, but it might be worth saying, because we get people listening to my show here who are considering hospice. And so Medicare does have benefit periods for hospice. They're unlimited, but they have rules, okay? And it makes sense that the benefit periods are unlimited, because the patient doesn't get to decide, doesn't have 100% control on whether or not they receive hospice services, because if they don't qualify or they've plateaued and have to be discharged, right? So it makes sense that there's benefit periods, but they're unlimited. So they go like this. You start out with two 90-day benefit periods, And then after that, you have 60-day benefit periods. So you have a 90, and you have to do a recert, and another 90, and you have to do a recert, and then you have 60s, 60, 60, 60. And before every single 60-day recertification, a face-to-face is required. Now, I've been shocked in the past when I've showed up at companies where the medical director, there were people in the agency that didn't quite understand how the face-to-faces worked. Okay, so when you before the patient can go into any 60-day benefit period, so when you go to certify them for the third time, you have the first one at admission, you have the second one after 90 days, and then you have a third one to start 60-day benefit periods. You have to have a face-to-face by a nurse practitioner or a medical director. Face-to-face means you're right there, face-to-face. Okay, and that face-to-face can't be any more than 30 days before the recertification. So if something happens and you do that face-to-face and you go to do the certification at 31 days, that is an untimely missed face-to-face, and you have to discharge that patient and readmit them before you can start billing for them again. And you are expected to continue services until you figure out how to get them discharged and readmitted. So if they have a family member that's down, you know, in Cancun for a week, then you get to take care of them for free for a whole week until they can come back and you can readmit the patient. You cannot miss a face-to-face. And the medical director cannot complete their certificate of terminal illness at IDT if the face-to-face is not completed. And if they do, you're in violation of that condition of participation and have to discharge the patient and readmit them again. All right, so that's the face-to-face requirements. Then you need to have a customized plan, a care plan. This is a big deal in hospice. You cannot have blanket care plans for your patients. And so every care plan needs to be customized and needs to be obvious that it was for that patient. And it doesn't have to be overcomplicated necessarily to show that it's for a different patient. That's not generally that hard to pull off. Something as simple as this patient, their pain scale is 5 is acceptable, 2 is the goal, 6 is when they need comfort medicine. Okay, that's customized for them. So don't overthink it, but your patient has the right to a customized plan of care that's tailored specifically to them. And if you look at the conditions of participation, everybody better have a pain care plan. 100% of all patients have to have a care plan for pain, even if pain isn't a problem for them. You know, they're an Alzheimer's patient. They never had pain their whole life. They're confused. They don't complain of pain. They don't grimace. No, mom never had any pain her whole life. Well, you still have a pain care plan required. We're required to have 24-hour nursing services. That means that you always have an RN or an LPN on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. That is a condition of participation. If you have a night where there's no nurse on call or whoever is on call doesn't answer the phone, you are in violation of that condition of participation and you've just created a service failure. We're going to talk about that a little bit more in agency philosophy, which we're almost to. Then finally, now I've picked and chosen. There's all kinds of other conditions here. There's patient rights. There's the quality performance, QAPI, quality improvement, performance improvement, QAPI, QAPI plan for everybody. But I'm just hitting some of the highlights here. You've got the agency is required to provide all 4 levels of care. I'll be honest with you. After a year in hospice, I couldn't tell you what the 4 levels of care were. I think it was because my agency was really good at just assuming we all knew, but I didn't. I went to a new job after 2 years of case management. I went to a new job and followed somebody who was at the last job with me. And I remember her looking at me going, that nurse over there, that nurse couldn't even tell you what the 4 levels of care are. And I'm like, Now, I did know what they were, but I didn't know that's what they were called. Does that make sense? And I'm going to read them off to you here, but I didn't know they were called the four levels of care. I just knew we did them. Okay. So they are routine, right? And that's just the normal living in a nursing home, ALF, you know, retirement village, you know, in a van down by the river, whatever it might be. That's routine where you're just seeing them where they are. Then there's respite, right? Where they can go into a facility that you contract with because the caregiver needs a break. They can have their 5 days of break from being a caregiver. You have continuous care, which is a nurse or a home health aide at the bedside for symptom management. The nurse, it has to be 51% nurse and 49% aide, but they can be at the bedside for hours to manage out of control symptoms. And then you have general inpatient care, which is like a freestanding hospice facility, or if you contract with a hospital, their sixth floor is their palliative comfort floor, and they're used to getting really sick hospice patients there. So there's your four levels of care: routine, respite, continuous care, and then general inpatient or hospice house or hospice facility. We had all four of those, and I knew what they were, but I didn't know they were called the four levels of care, and I didn't know Medicare mandated them, if that makes sense. And so there might be somebody listening to this right now, or maybe you're considering hospice. I'm getting a lot of emails and feedback from nurses and even other specialties who are in nursing school or considering hospice who listen to this show. So welcome to all of you, and I'm glad this show is helping you out. So, and then finally, we'll move into agency philosophy when it comes to service failures. And this, I'm guessing this is actually what the email was from Jade on this. But hey, listen, if I just rattled off a few of these, it would be too short of a show.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I have had some members at the hospice nursing community request some kind of a support group to help fight burnout. And so I have started two burnout support groups at the hospicenursingcommunity.com just to help everybody. And so these support groups meet twice a month on the second Thursday and the second Sunday of the month. And so we're going to be doing that. And I wanted to make sure you understood or knew that these will be faith-friendly support groups. And it doesn't mean they'll be preaching or anything strange like that, but I might use devotionals. I might pull something out of the Bible, maybe out of Psalms or something, but just there might be sections of the group that deal with matters of faith. And I hope that is of interest to you. It can be found in the community events section of the community. So if you would consider joining, I think it would help you. It's going to help me. I need it, I think, as much as anybody does. So join a burnout support group at thehospicenursingcommunity.com. So I wanted to kind of hit both sides of what is probably the same coin. So now, agency philosophy service failures are basically any time an agency feels like they didn't meet the patient's expectations or needs. And so this can vary widely between agencies based on their policies, okay? Just based on their philosophy of care. Like at my agency, we see most of our patients twice a week, as I've talked about on this. And so if we have a patient that can't ever seem to get their twice a week visits, to a certain degree, I am seeing that as a service failure because I know the domino effect that follows a patient who's just not getting enough visits and not being seen enough. And we'll get into a little bit of that here when I hit some other points. But here's just some quick thoughts that I had that I could see as being a service failure. And I'll just run through these and drop a few thoughts on you and we'll call it good. But here's what I think, like in the category of visit frequencies, and as far as just visits in general, if we have a missed visit and nobody bothered to call the patient or the caregiver and they're waiting around all day for a nurse who isn't going to be there. And this can happen sometimes. Like, I recognize that we have nurses who have to call in, and it's not, you know, home, patients and families and facilities think we have 100 nurses sitting around at the office waiting for somebody to go see. And of course, that's not true in any area of medicine, right? Nowhere says, oh, we just hire all these nurses to sit over here in case somebody needs them. And so somebody's going to call in, and we might look at their 5 visits for the day or their 6 visits for the day and go, oh, I know that patient. She's going to be okay with just 1 visit this week or no visit this week. But then we forget to tell her. We forget to call her up and go, hey, Mary's sick today. Are you going to be okay if she just sees you later this week? And of course, you always want to say, listen, we can get somebody out there. Are you doing okay? Like, the patient still needs to be the one to agree to the missed visit. Because you can't just put, you know, it was a holiday, so we didn't see him. Like, you can't do that. The patient needs to have some say in it. But, and generally, they're pretty cool. Oh, yeah, yeah, I'm good to this week. We'll just see you on Friday. But a missed visit by the nurse or the aide, and nobody bothered to call them, and they're waiting all day long. I mean, that's a service failure, right? That's a failure to meet their needs and expectations. How about the patient died without ever being put on daily visits? They got worse and worse and worse, and then died, and nobody had been out there to check on them or see them as they were getting worse. Now, this is going to happen. Nobody has a crystal ball. Patients do die without telling us they're gonna, right? Heart failure patient, and they just have a heart attack or something happens. They have this big syncopal episode, and they pass. But this should not be the norm. If you have a lot of patients that all of you're just constantly getting calls that so-and-so died and such died, and nobody saw it coming, you're looking at what could possibly be service failures, that somehow your agency, you have a nurse or a team of nurses or whatever that don't recognize a patient who's transitioning and active very well, because it should not happen a lot. It's going to happen some, but you should not have like this one nurse that their patients are constantly dying without notice. That, to me, there's a service failure going on there. This patient should have been getting some daily visits, some of them. How about medication refills? Letting patients run out of their medications. Pain meds ran out of, or their blood pressure medicine ran out, whatever it is. But letting our patients run out of their medications at home is an absolute service failure to that patient. It breaks down their confidence and trust in the agency they're working for, or they're working for, they're being cared for by. So it's a big deal. Running out of supplies, briefs, pads, wipes, sponges, like I could go on and on, but just running out of supplies for that patient and them constantly having to call the office, you know, like they're almost one of the employees because they're having to call the office. I ran out of pads again. My mom is out of hydrocodone again. Can you help? This is going to happen some, but if it happens a lot, there's a breakdown in your organization. How about this? Calling 911 and going to the hospital. Something's going on if you have very many patients who are going to the hospital. If you have a live discharge rate of 40%, you have a lot of service failures going on. And it's usually multiple ones that push patients and families to run off to the hospital all the time. Either they didn't understand the service, or they didn't feel very connected to the team. There's a lot of different things that can play into them calling 911. But I see a phone call and a trip to the ER and a 911 call. I'm always going to start from the standpoint of, was this a service failure? Where did we fail this patient that they feel like their solution is 911? And if it goes all the way back to admission and, you know, they didn't understand the service they were on, that's fine. Now, if it's denial, they signed up and they're just like in the last minute going, no, not ready. Yeah, that's a whole other thing, but it needs to be scrutinized. How about a patient who dies in pain? that happens in hospice. It is an absolute tragedy when it happens, and I absolutely hate it, but it happens when a patient dies and they're not comfortable. And that usually means we didn't make enough visits to keep them comfortable. We didn't show up when they needed us. There's some different things that can play into that. We didn't really work with our doctor close enough. There's a lot of different nuances here. Now, I'm not talking about the patient whose family says, Mama's going to die a natural death and you're not giving her all those meds. Like, that's all on them. I've talked about that on this show, but that's not what I'm talking about. Talking about we've got upset families because they just don't think Dad was as comfortable as he needed to be. And to be honest with you, I can't imagine a bigger tragedy for a hospice patient. When that happens, and it's happened, I've seen it happen in my own agencies I've been responsible for, and it just makes me sick to my stomach because that family is never going to forget it and probably never going to forgive us, and we don't deserve to be forgiven. But it's going to happen. But it can happen if you're not hyper-vigilant on visits and stuff. There's service failures can happen a lot with an on-call team if we're not careful. If we have a family member, if we have a patient or family member who called multiple times overnight or multiple times on a weekend and a visit was never made. And this can really happen when we are trying to fix everything over the phone instead of making a visit. I think this happens a lot in hospice, especially when the on-call team is having a rough, long weekend and they're hoping to solve the problem over the phone. Hey, listen, this applies to the day shift too. When you get in a call, like if you got your 5 or 6 visits and it's a Tuesday and you have a patient, family who's reached out to you because their loved one is not comfortable and you're just trying to solve it over the phone all day long, and it never really happens, and you don't get with your team to get another nurse to head that way, or you don't adjust your day and move people around so you can get by there, and they're in pain and they don't get a visit. That's a service failure. That is every kind of service failure, because we've got to make sure that our patients are getting the visits that they need to address their concerns, and it needs to be done timely. And finally, anything that the patient perceives as a negative. That's a hard one, isn't it? That we're going to place in the hands of our patients and their caregivers to define for us what a service failure is. But that's the work that we're in, that sometimes they are going to be the ones who determine what a service failure is based on their understanding of what they are supposed to receive from the hospice agency. So just some things that I think a patient or family member perception can be is slow response times to needs. If they called on a Monday or a Tuesday and say, hey, I need to talk to my case manager, Betty, about Jeff's, my husband's, his edema in his legs, or if I need a refill on this medication, and it takes the nurse 2 hours to bother to call him back, rather than as soon as you get out of the visit, giving them a ring. So slow response times to needs. Staff being impatient, grumpy, or basically uncaring, blowing off what they consider to be important, and the nurse acting like it's not important to them. Not taking the time to explain things. If a patient or family member feel like you rushed through it, then you did. Whether you think you did or you're telling me, well, they're just kind of dumb and not picking up on it. Either way, it's a service failure if they feel like you're not taking time to explain stuff to them. This is a hard one. I'm going to lay this one on you. The RN case manager constantly changing. And listen, I'll admit it has taken us a lot of work at my agency I'm with right now to not screw this up, because we're growing kind of fast. We have nurses traveling long ways to cover for patients until we can replace our staffing. So we have to be super intentional. Like, who are we going to give this patient to? Because is it going to cause us to have to change who the care the the case manager is later. And we have to really be careful, you know, or if your agency has a ton of turnover, and so every 2 months, your patients are constantly getting, you have a whole team of patients to get a new nurse every 2 or 3 months. That's a service failure from the eyes of the patient or the family member. So just, you know, this lack of staff consistency, like, you know, if your agency, if you have if you have an RN who just sees patients one time a week and then the other time is seen by a couple of different LPNs, so in any given week they can have three different nurses there, they may see that as a service failure from your agency because it's just too much variety and too much change and not enough consistency with who's going to be coming into their house. Like, I think it's real easy in leadership sometimes to just look for RNs who are available to make a visit because it just needs to be an RN. And we think we've done a good job because we're making sure they're getting a visit and it's by an RN. And we haven't stopped to think, well, gosh, this will be the third different RN they've seen in 3 weeks. Is there a way for us to make sure it's at least the same RN that was in there last week, so it's a familiar face? Just things like that. How about nobody following up after a rough weekend? And I've ran into this so many times over the years because the nurse is like, I go to that part of town on Tuesdays, so I'm not going to see him Monday. And the patient had a horrible week and they're transitioning. And for some reason, the nurse doesn't think it's important to try to check in on them on Monday. And we're just going to see them Tuesday and they're left out there kind of hanging for a day. Man, at least make a phone call or something. And to touch base with them, that phone call is so important to really, you can't over communicate with your families. Like, it's impossible to over communicate with your families. So, Jade, I hope that helped you out a little bit, my friend. I hope that answers some of your questions. Well, I hope I didn't rattle that off too quick. We're at 45 minutes at the tone. Just kidding. Hey, would you take a minute to leave a review of the show? You know, before I get too excited here, service failures are a big deal. Sometimes I get so excited to do my wrap up and my close. Sometimes I don't think I close on the content very well. And it takes a lot of work to cut down on service failures. You're going to have them. Your agency is going to have them. Just like your equipment company is going to mess up. But how do you respond? That's the big question. You know, do we respond quickly and make it right? That will go a long way. Hey, listen, if you want me to do a show based on your idea, or you just want to give me some feedback, call me at 816-834-9191. Email me at james@confessionsofahospicenurse.net. Hey, and join the hospicenursingcommunity.com for more coaching tips and tricks. And remember, hospice doesn't get easier. You just get better at it. And let's get better at it together. This has been episode 49 of the Hospice Nursing Podcast for February 18th, 2024.